KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. In the summer of 1776, 13 colonies secede from the British Empire. The British send their largest armada across the Atlantic to quell the rebellion. A revolution begins. Historian Joseph Ellis offers a new perspective on the Revolutionary War in his latest book, Revolutionary Summer: The Birth of American Independence. Ellis spoke at Town Hall on July 10, 2013.
I came from Massachusetts and I brought good weather and the Boston Red Sox with me. You walk around Seattle, I did that the last day and a half, and there are all these people with Red Sox shirts on, you know, all these people that follow the Red Sox. It's really strange. I'm here to talk to you this evening for about 35 or 40 minutes about a very old story that's been told and retold over 200 years, so I better darn sight have something fresh and interesting to say about it. It's a familiar story. It's present in most of the history books. The play, 1776, is one of the more popular and performed plays in the current theatrical repertoire. Sometimes when I was starting to do the work on this, I thought that each generation of Americans and American historians has tried to come up with some kind of new way of understanding how American independence happened. And one of my job, and it was like layers of wallpaper, you know, one after the other, and my job was not to add a new layer so much as to tear off all the old ones and get back to the wall. And so sometimes what I have to say might seem, I hope, new, but it's in fact so old that we've forgotten it. There's some new stuff too. Now all this is in fact, as we all understand, a thinly veiled attempt to get you to purchase my undoubtedly magisterial new book. I believe that maintaining that thin veneer is a good thing. Mainly we should talk about the history rather than the book. And so I'm not going to mention the book again, except to say that I have one son, my last son, in college, and that all royalties from this book will immediately go into the Alexander Ellis Scholarship Fund. I began my work on this book with two assumptions and one question. They might have been not just assumptions, they might have been presumptions. I'll let you judge. The first is that the American Revolution is an event which looks more inevitable in retrospect than almost any event in American history, but was in fact, at the time, highly problematic and unlikely. If you lived through it, it was an act of improvisation on the edge of catastrophe and confusion. My old mentor from Yale days, who died yesterday, and it was nice long a bit in the Times today and in the AP, Edmund Morgan, great man, died at the ripe old age of 97. He once said, a revolution is a change in human events so profound and so turbulent, so traumatic, that no one at the time ever quite understands it, and no one ever after really does either. This is not a definition calculated to buoy the spirits of American historians who are in the business of trying to explain confusing events. Though I must say, in retrospect here, trying to write clearly and cogently about confusion is a challenge, and I hope I am up to it or was up to it. that the second presumption, is that there is a very obvious fact at the center of the coming of the American Revolution that doesn't get into the history books with sufficient emphasis. It's this: the war starts in the spring of 75 at Lexington, Concord, and then a huge and really bloody battle at Bunker Hill, where the British lose almost half their attack force. At the end of the Bunker Hill battle, one retired British general in London was heard to say that a few more victories like this and the British Army will be annihilated. The war starts 15 months before we declare independence. So you've got this time when the war started and there is a military engagement going on, and the British are raiding New England coasts and bombing cities or using their ships to fire on American cities, Newport and other places in Connecticut. And lots of things going on militarily, and yet there hasn't been a resolution or a consensus outside New England about independence. And I make a lot about that, as I think you will see. If those are the two assumptions, the question is what I call the Wilkes-Barre question. Trying to be clever. The population of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania today is slightly larger than the population of Virginia in 1776. Now, if we go out to Wilkes-Barre, are we going to find George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Mason, Patrick Henry, and John Marshall? You ain't going to find them. Now, at some level, theoretically, they're there in latent form, but we won't find them. And what this calls to attention is the extent to which this moment in American history generated pressure to create leadership which is unprecedented in American history. And I'm not apologizing for all their failures here. A lot of these people are slave owners, and we're not going to get into that kind of moralistic nonsense. But this is political leadership at the highest order. And so why did that happen? That's my question. The Toynbeean answer is, that is after the historian Toynbee, British historian, only in great crises can leadership emerge. And therefore, leadership emerged because this was a great crisis. Well, that's pretty convenient, but it doesn't address the fact that we can think of a lot of occasions in world and American history when there are great crises and leadership doesn't emerge. Like right now. I mean, from my point of view, the greatest threat to the planet in my lifetime, in my children and grandchildren's lifetime, is global warming. And we're not going to do a damn thing about it. Anyway, I won't go off on that. But what is the reason why we get this generation of leadership at this moment? I don't think I have an answer that's over a large scale answer. I have an anecdotal answer for you to brood about, to help you think about it. When Washington decided to head up to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia in the May of 75, now note, Lexington and Concord have happened. He puts on his military uniform. Hasn't had that on for a long time. And he says to his manager, Lund Washington, who is a second cousin, he says, Lund, when the British come up the Potomac to destroy Mount Vernon, I want you to get out my books and Martha, presumably not in that order. Washington assumed that he was going to lose everything. Washington assumed there was going to be a war. He was going to be a leader in the American Continental Army, what becomes the Continental Army. It hadn't been created yet. And that when he made that decision, he was risking what Jefferson, 14 months later, will say, your life, your fortune, and your sacred honor. He assumed that. This allows us to get a glimpse of the degree of the crisis and the pressure it puts on people to make decisions on one side or the other here. It is an enormous amount of pressure. I mean, any political candidate who decides to run for the presidency of the United States has got to make a decision to basically give up his or her personal life for the rest of his life. But he doesn't have to give up everything. I don't know why the hell they decide to do that, by the way. You got to be crazy to do that. At any rate, the American Revolution was a crisis that propelled to the top a generation of political leadership beyond Virginia, to be sure. John Adams would have been a country lawyer. Alexander Hamilton, who was literally a bastard, gosh knows what would have happened to him. Washington's leader, second in command in the Continental Army, was a guy called Nathaniel Greene. Is a merchant from, a Quaker merchant from Providence, Rhode Island, never fired a shot in anger. What would have happened? I mean, you would have never heard of him. So, understanding both the improvisational character of this moment and the crisis-driven character of it is important for us to begin our telling of the story.
Joseph Ellis, the author of Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. He spoke at Town Hall on July 10th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Joseph Ellis in a moment, 819, 94.9 KUOW. Later this evening, a look at the activities and methods of the Institute for the Study and Practice of Nonviolence in Providence, Rhode Island, headed by a former Israeli Army sergeant and staffed by former felons. It was organized to reduce gang-related violence and intervene positively in the lives of at-risk youth. That'll be tonight at 10:30. In other programming coming up later this evening, we'll hear a prominent Arab American analyst and pollster weigh the impact of the violent turn of events in Egypt. Also, a visit to the Haida Gwaii, a.k.a. the Queen Charlotte Islands of British Columbia, to talk to the principal carver of the first totem pole to be erected there in more than a century. And a former NDP leader tells why she's outraged that an American reality TV crew has been allowed to ride along with the White Horse RCMP to film arrests. All three of those items tonight, beginning right after the 11 o'clock news. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight, lows around 60, cloudy. Also a chance of showers. Friday highs in the 70s, partly sunny. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows around 60, mostly cloudy. Saturday highs lower to mid-70s, mostly cloudy, becoming partly sunny in the afternoon.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. It started with dumping tea into the Boston Harbor. and it grew into a world war that would lead to American independence. Historian Joseph Ellis offers a new perspective on the Revolutionary War in his latest book, Revolutionary Summer: The Birth of American Independence. Ellis spoke at Town Hall on July 10th, 2013.
One of the second things that I concluded that doesn't get enough emphasis in most interpretations is that this was an unnecessary war. That is to say, a diplomatic resolution of the constitutional crisis between Great Britain and the colonies was self-evident, to use Jefferson's term. And it was only by late spring and early summer of 76 that it became something other than a diplomatic resolution. In Great Britain, as great leaders as both William Pitt and Edmund Burke argued for a diplomatic resolution. And in the Continental Congress, both Thomas Jefferson and John Dickinson, representative from Pennsylvania, wrote what was called the Olive Branch Petition to the King, proposing the proper terms for a diplomatic resolution. And a majority of delegates in the Continental Congress believed that this was the way it was going to end up until late spring. What's the way they thought of? Here's the diplomatic answer. Great Britain acknowledges the right of American colonies to tax and legislate for themselves, done through their local assemblies or legislatures. The American colonies recognize the authority of the king as their monarch and remain in the empire for economic reasons, abiding by the navigation acts, which are beneficial to both sides, and remaining, as I say, part of the British Empire. This answer is clear to both sides. If the British had embraced this answer, we would have discovered the British Commonwealth 100 years early, and you wouldn't have had the American Revolution. Eventually, over 100 years, we would have evolved, like Canada did, into an independent kind of place, but you wouldn't have had this crisis. Why didn't this happen? Why was the obvious diplomatic answer rejected? And it was rejected by Great Britain, not by us. That's why Jefferson says prudence dictates that, you know, you will not declare revolutions for light and transient causes. They really presumed we were going to work this out. The Americans did. So why do the British decide to make this a war? Why do they militarize the conflict? Well, part of it is because they've already militarized it. It's already going on. But the great British jurist William Blackstone declared in 1765 in a famous paper pamphlet, there must be a single source of sovereignty in every government, and that includes in every empire, a final place where ultimate resolutions are made. What the colonists were proposing was multiple sovereignty. The colonial legislatures had sovereignty over each of their own respective colonies. They were proposing that it wasn't one god, there were many gods. Now, if you'll notice, the Constitution is also multiple sovereignties. They're discovering something modern here. Blackstone's view is very Aristotelian. The new view is kind of Madisonian, pluralistic. But from a British point of view, you can't grant them sovereignty without surrendering control of the British Empire. Why don't they want to surrender control in that modest way? Well, it's an early version of what comes to be called the domino theory. If we grant the Americans this right, what happens in Scotland? What happens in Ireland? What happens in India? We cannot afford to be lenient to our American cousins for fear of the implications for the rest of the empire. Finally, why should we think about this at all? We have the military power to put this rebellion down and squash it. The British Army and Navy is the most powerful military force on the planet. The British Army by itself isn't. The French Army and the Prussian Army are as good or better. But you put the British Army with the British Navy, numero uno. So we have no practical or realistic reason to make any concessions because we have the power to squash this insurrection. And in early spring of 1776, that is precisely what George III decides to do. He appoints a new secretary for the American colonies, the equivalent of the new Secretary of War, named George Germain. He authorizes him to prepare the largest amphibious force ever to cross the Atlantic, 42,000 troops, 417 ships. The next time anything this big crosses the Atlantic is going to be in World War I. We're going to put this thing down, kill this rebellion in the cradle. Okay. The American colonies, up till that point in time, have been assuming that this ongoing war will be ended diplomatically. Tom Paine's pamphlet, which appears in January of 76 and spreads in the early spring, is a major influence on colonial opinion because it's a direct assault on the king. Up till then, they've been willing to deny Parliament's authority, but not willing to deny King George's authority. King George is our friend. He doesn't really know what's going on. These are, quote, ministerial troops here, all these fictions designed to preserve a link with the British monarchy. Paine's pamphlet is an attempt to break that link. But what makes Paine's pamphlet so potent is that it's occurring at the same time as news of the looming invasion is arriving in America. That's what really changes popular opinion in the colonies. And you can really see, how do I know this? I mean, am I just making, you know, we didn't have Harris polls back then to rely on. And so what is the evidence that I'm using to substantiate this dramatic change in popular opinion in late spring and early summer? On May 15th, 1776, the Continental Congress sends out a resolution requesting each colony to rewrite its colonial charter as a state constitution. The guy who writes this resolution is John Adams. Adams thinks this is a de facto declaration of independence. He likes to think that since he wrote it. And when Jefferson gets all the credit, he thinks, wait a minute, you know, I'm the one who really led the way. And you can see why he thinks that. I mean, if you're in a state, a colony, the only reason you're going to rewrite your colonial charter is if you're agreeing to support independence. All right, they sent this request to every colonial governor and legislature. The colonial governor and legislature sent it out to all the counties and towns in the respective colony. In Massachusetts, for example, 42 towns. The 42 towns in Massachusetts and corresponding counties and towns and all the other colonies wrote back to express their opinion. I've read all their responses. They are in this obscure 9-volume document called American Archives, which is present in most research libraries. It's hard to use because it's not indexed and the documents gathered. It's like 9 volumes, 1,000 pages each volume, by this guy called Charles Force in the 1840s. Before the generation completely died out, he wanted to get everything he could before it disappeared. So he got all the pamphlets and newspaper articles and parliamentary debates, but he got all these responses. And guess what they say? They all say the same thing. A few months ago, we could not believe we are saying this. But we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. That's where the phrase comes from. They all start with that. To this particular cause. That's where Jefferson got it from. And we have no choice because we're being invaded. And King George has declared his independence of us. Okay? So the real clincher is the military side of the bargain here. And that's what makes the difference in producing the consensus that didn't exist beforehand. Now, a couple of things on the political... One of the things I do in the book is I move between Philadelphia and the Congress and New York and the Continental Army, because that's where the invasion's coming, in New York, okay? That's tricky, but I think... And I try to devote about half the time to each side. But on the political side, remember, there's a famous portrait by John Trumbull. The original hangs in the rotunda of the Capitol. It's called the Declaration of Independence. And if you Google it, there's about 20 different facsimile versions of it. Some of them say July 4th, 1776. And it shows five guys approaching the desk where another guy is sitting. Three of the five guys are recognizable. They're Jefferson, Adams, and Franklin. The guy at the desk is John Hancock, the president of the Congress, okay? Most everybody thinks this is the signing ceremony on July 4th. It's June 28th. It's when the committee that drafted the document submits it to the full Congress. Okay? In the play, on July 4th, they all get up, they play the music, and they sign it. Never happened. Nobody signed it on the 4th. The only thing they did on the 4th was send it to the printer. But at the top of it, they wrote July 4th, 1776. Okay? Now, most places didn't hear about this for a week or 2 weeks until afterwards, but most of them signed it on August 2nd. They signed the parchment copy. But there are people coming in late, stragglers and other reluctant revolutionaries coming in as late as October. One of them, Robert Morris, who is one of the wealthiest guys in America from Philadelphia, he doesn't sign. He believes this war is going to be ruinous for both sides until very late. But even though he's one of the last ones to sign, he signs at the top. He puts its name first at the top. Very clever. The military side of this story is also important as you get into July and August, because at the same time that they're agreeing to vote on a resolution for independence, they vote on the resolution on July 2nd. That's the day Adams thinks is the national anniversary. He's up until the time he dies, he thinks we have the wrong date. He tells Abigail this. And then, this is Ellis's version of the story, he and Jefferson decide to make July 4th the right date. They die on July 4th, 1826. I mean, they die on schedule, baby. And these guys, something else. Madison dies on July 5th. Monroe dies on July 4th. They can will their own deaths. the military side of the story. At the same time as they're doing this in Philadelphia, the British fleet is landing on Staten Island. The very day they voted independence, the first wave of William Howe's army is landing. Okay? Now, and the Continental Army has moved down from Boston to defend New York. New York, if you look at a map, is an archipelago. It's three islands, Staten Island, Long Island, and Manhattan. Whoever controls the sea controls the battle. And there is no question as to who controls the sea. From a strategic point of view, New York is indefensible. So why does Washington decide to defend it? He knows that. He's got reports on this, okay? Well, first, because the Continental Congress tells him to defend it. And he's a believer in the civilian control of the military. They don't fully gather how risky this is going to be, the Continental Congress. They think, look, we just declared independence. How will it appear if, as soon as we declare independence, our army retreats to New Jersey or Connecticut? That won't look very good. Of course, no one asked the question, it won't look very good either if they're annihilated on Long Island. And believe me, that almost happens. There's a second reason that Washington decides to defend New York. It's personal. Washington is an honor-driven man. Many of the officers in the Continental Army are this way. It makes it difficult at times to understand why they do what they do. Like, if two armies are approaching and the other army is leveling its muskets at you, why don't you lie down? Why do you wait to be disemboweled or beheaded? It's not honorable. Why do you regard retreat as unacceptable? Because it reflects badly on your character as an officer. And something like that is operative in Washington's mind at this moment, too. Washington believes that if General Howe and his brother Richard Howe, the admiral, decide to attack in New York, and they are, he is honor-bound to oppose them. It is like a summons to duel. You cannot refuse it. This is stupid. But this is the way he thought. And it is the ultimate source of a catastrophe. Washington begins the Battle of New York in August of 76 with 28,000 troops. About half of them are militia, who are virtually worthless, despite the myth of the militia. The average experience of a soldier in the Continental Army is less than 6 months. The average experience of a soldier in the British Army is 7.5 years. Officers, it's even more so. It's a group of amateurs fighting a group of professionals. The amateurs believe that they have a chance of winning because they have the superior cause. And virtue will triumph against experience. In some fairy tales, that's true. It's not true in battle. He begins with 28,000. He ends up with 4,000. He's trapped on Long Island. The British have him trapped completely. They've lost about 2,000 at that stage, the Americans have. And it's bad weather, blah, blah, blah. And Washington stages what is, in some ways, the most brilliant and consequential maneuver of the entire war, more so than crossing the Delaware, more so than Yorktown. He escapes across the East River at night. It's an early American version of what's the British evacuation? Dunkirk. Thank you, sir. Only it's more dramatic because it happens overnight. It has to have everything go perfectly. The nor'easter has to come in and put currents in the river that make it difficult for the British to patrol the East River. A fog has to come in to cover the last group's retreat. He gets the entire army across the East River with only two casualties. He's the last one on the last boat to go across. Think about it. What would have happened if they destroyed the whole Continental Army? That's a question worthy of thinking about in terms of the future of the war.
Joseph Ellis, the author of Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. He spoke at Town Hall on July 10th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Joseph Ellis in a moment, 842 94.9 KUOW. As Omar Khadr approaches his first year in a maximum security Canadian prison, his lawyer hopes to make the case that Mr. Khadr is being treated unfairly in Canada. We'll hear that. We'll hear about it later this evening, namely in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. Also later this evening, scores have been killed in Egypt's crackdown on supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. We're going to hear a conversation about the state of emergency and international reactions to it. That'll be tonight at midnight. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight. Lows around 60, cloudy skies. A chance of showers as well. Friday highs somewhere in the 70s, partly sunny. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows around 60, mostly cloudy. And Saturday highs lower to mid-70s, starting out mostly cloudy and then becoming at least partly sunny by afternoon. Prometheus Brown of Blue Scholars and hip-hop teacher Dr. Dowdy Abe talk about the history of Seattle area hip-hop next hour. Also next hour, a look at how a disease that's killing bats all over the country seems to be strangely absent from the state of Maine, and Jamin Shively, the former Microsoft corporate strategy manager turned marijuana entrepreneur, talks about his desire to create a national premium marijuana brand. All three of those items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Joseph Ellis is an American historian and the author of 8 books, including Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. This was the subject of his town hall talk on July 10th, 2013. Next, he references the Howe brothers, who were generals in the British Army.
Here is another little interesting, not-so-known fact. Both of the Howe brothers don't want to destroy the Continental Army. They want to deliver a stunning blow to it that's proportionate. They don't want this war to become a genocidal war, like the war against the Scots and the war against the Irish. They want this to be a war that ends with reconciliation, bringing the Americans back into the empire. Both of the Howes were members of Parliament. Both of them voted against an aggressive policy towards the colonies. They opposed the very military policy they were implementing. By the way, so did Geoffrey Amherst. Geoffrey Amherst refused to serve as commander of the British Army. He was the first one offered it. Said, I will not fight the Americans. Why did they do that? They believe that if they go over and in their capacity as admiral and general successfully demonstrate to the colonists that they can't win this war, defeat them handily, quickly, they can negotiate a peace. The very peace that everybody else had always been assuming would be the one to be operative. Okay, stay in the empire, take care of your own internal affairs, remain loyal to the king, Now, we're going to have to round up some of the leadership guys like Washington and Franklin and Adams, and we're going to have to hang them. But then everything will go back to okay. One of the reasons Washington is never going to buy this deal is for the obvious reason. He's not suicidal. There's a conference after the British defeat the Americans on Long Island, and it's harder to talk off the cuff here about battles. If you read the book, you'll see what really is playing out here. But after the Battle of Long Island and after the Continental Army gets off, it's still trapped on Manhattan because they control both the East River and the Hudson River, and you can't get off the island. And Richard Howe requests some kind of conference. And the Continental Congress goes through all these diplomatic and political shenanigans because, on the one hand, Howe can't address them as the official representatives of the American government because they don't recognize that. On the other hand, they don't want to agree to anything that makes it look like they're subservient. They send three people to meet with Richard Howe on Staten Island, the stone house on Staten Island that's still there. Howe says this: look, we've just demonstrated to you that you can't win this war. You've suffered enormous casualties. Give it up. Step back from independence, and we can then talk about the proper posture of the colonies and the empire. I don't have the authority to give you any complete guarantees, but believe me, that is something that the king wants. Adams says, no way. Once we cross the line, there's no turning back. There have already been too many people killed, too much blood spilled. And this is interesting. If you defeat us here and trap the whole army, it doesn't make any difference. We'll just raise another army. There are 250,000 Americans between the ages of 15 and 50 prepared to fight. We'll just find another Washington, too. Now, whether you can ever find another Washington is an interesting question. And Franklin says something similar. And Franklin is old friends with Richard Howe from Britain. They both worked together back in London trying to convince the government not to do this. Franklin says, Lord Richard, my advice to you is to take your fleet and go back. Now, Howe is saying to us, we don't have a chance to win. Okay? Franklin is saying to Howe, the British have no chance to win. Why? You're not fighting an army. You're fighting a people. We have the demographic resources to sustain this conflict to infinite time in the future, longer than the British public will ever be willing to support. This will be looked upon, this is an interesting comparison, as one of the Crusades. And you will be looked upon as one of those people who failed to recover the Holy Land. So give up now. There's another guy named Rutledge who from South Carolina says, yeah, and why, if just accept our independence, and we'll start trading with you. Well, that's not what Richard Howe had in mind, of course. But it's if you get back and you peel the wallpaper off and get back to that, what you begin to see is that the traditional question that has been posed about the war, which is how could a ragtag group of amateurs who had never cooperated with each other in any earlier political crisis come together to defeat the dominant military power on the planet? That's an interesting question. A lot of people wrote books about that. We got the myth of the militia stuff in there. If you think about it a little differently, it is, did the British ever have a chance? And my answer is, once they missed the chance to destroy the Continental Army, that was it. They had one chance. And that's not a certainty that it would turn to, you know, it is impossible to know what would have happened. I wrote 6 American historians about this, and they all disagree about it. But the real question is one that we can see more clearly now in the wake of our experience in Southeast Asia and the Middle East. It is very difficult for an occupying army to subjugate an insurgency. It takes an enormous amount of patience, money, and staying power. And most representative governments aren't prepared to do that. If you're a monarchy, you can do it more easily. So I'm saying that our perspective on the military conflict, in my interpretation, should be changing a little bit. If you ask me, I don't say this in the book because I don't want to be called on it, and so if they had destroyed the Continental Army and they got Washington and his staff, I would say there's between a 30 and a 50% chance that the American colonists' will would have been broken and they would have negotiated some kind of armistice for a solution along the diplomatic lines that had been proposed earlier. The will in the Continental Congress itself was really strong, because most of those guys were going to get hung. And so if you read the letters to the delegates in the Congress, boy, they're really committed. They're never going back. Out there in the countryside, 20% are loyalists. The other 80% aren't all complete patriots, and it varies from region to region. New England is the most committed. But there's this middle group of 30 or 40% that are neutral, and I think that's the crucial group. And how they would have responded to the destruction of the Continental Army is unknowable, but I think it, at least in my view, is 30 to 40% possible that the war would have ended right then, and we would have created the British Commonwealth. One of the consequences of the summer of 76 is that Washington comes to understand how he has to fight the war. This honor-driven stuff is all fine in medieval chivalric lore, but it's clear that the Continental Army is not a match for the British Army on equal terms. Therefore, he's got to fight what he calls a war of posts. It's not quite a guerrilla war, because a guerrilla war is not regular troops. But it means he's only going to engage the British on terrain that's quite favorable to his side, where there's an escape route, where there's never the opportunity for the Continental Army to be destroyed. That's going to make it very difficult to get him. Okay? And the reason he's doing this, apart from the experience of the New York campaign, is he comes to understand an elemental strategic fact, which is one reason he's great. He doesn't have to win. The British have to win. He only has to not lose. That is a huge insight. If you think back on the great generals in world history, most of them end up losers. Hannibal, Napoleon, Robert E. Lee, Rommel. Washington loses more battles than he wins, but he wins the war because he understands what the strategic realities are. If you protract this war and sustain the Continental Army. The British are always searching for the strategic center of the rebellion. Is it New England, Boston? Is it New York? Is it Philadelphia? Is it Charleston? It's not a place. It's the Continental Army. And as long as you keep the Continental Army intact, you can't lose. And if you can't lose, they can't win, and that means you win, which is the way it happens. A final thought that's perhaps tangential, but I think of interest, and it relates to what I was saying about the way in which our perception of the British predicament is a function of our own experience as an imperial power. When we started the invasion of Iraq, this op-ed editor at the LA Times wrote me and said, or called me and said, I want you to write a piece on what Washington would say about Iraq. What should we do? So I wrote back and I said, well, he wouldn't know where it was. Nor would he know about weapons of mass destruction, jihad, 9/11, any of that. And that trying to bring that kind of 18th century character into the present is like trying to plant cut flowers. We have something to learn from them, but it can't be quite that explicit and direct. Okay, and it needs a translation. So she said, that's fine, just write the piece. And so what I wrote was a piece that said, Washington would have said, we've become the British. And he wouldn't be able to understand that. Now, if you take a poll among most Americans about whether or not the United States is an empire, overwhelmingly say no. If you take a vote among everybody else on the planet, they all say yes. So we're an empire in denial. And the reason we're in denial is because our origins as a republic, as an anti-imperial republic, are fundamentally antithetical to the exercise of imperial power. An empire is based on the principle of coercion. A republic is based on the principle of consent. So there's a fundamental contradiction in American foreign policy that's been going on for almost 70 years, all my lifetime. And while we talk about this in the context of specific conflicts, you know, whether it's Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, I think we need to have a larger conversation about who we are as a people and a nation and how we started. And I'm willing to play a role in that if we ever get it started. Thank you so much.
Joseph Ellis, the author of Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. He spoke at Town Hall on July 10th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW. 94.9 Seattle.
8:59 KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Today's KUOW Day sponsor is Robin Shapiro, thanking Doug Plummer for enjoying and enduring 20 years of the happiest marriage they know. And support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance Proton Therapy, a ProCure center. At SCCA Proton Therapy, doctors treat certain
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.